Hello, and welcome to Fireside Chats, both new and returning listeners. I am your host, Brooke Ryback, and this episode is finishing off my summer special series that and I know that we're going into Freshers Week, so I highly recommend you check out the two previous episodes I did with my dad back in San Diego, which was not only super insightful, but really fun. But this conversation, I think, will be a good wrap up on what I've personally been up to over the past few months and brings in a very commendable guest. So I'm super excited. For this episode, I want to take you into my world, what it sounded like, what it felt like, which was filled with children's laughter and every art supply you could possibly imagine. Thus, it's been a colorful and exhilarating summer, one that my parents claimed reverted me back to my own childhood, which was not only a funny joke between the family, but it was also really comforting and profoundly fulfilling. And so, as a caveat as well, to bring you into my world, I wanted to experiment with the mini mics that I've been using over the summer and interview at where I was working. So if you hear a kiddo scream or laugh or a parent or two, that is why. I just wanted to play with the soundscape. And so, yeah. But anyways, for the past 2 summers, I worked at the New Children's Museum in San Diego, which is an art museum for children where local artists will put up an exhibit for about a couple years, and then if it's really popular, we'll keep it. If it's time for change, we will. But basically, local artists will come up with exhibits that really get the kids interacting with the exhibit space to encourage kids to learn through play and through art. So, yeah, and lucky for me, since I've been working for a while there, I've reconnected with some amazing souls just as passionate to support children's education. I have known Miss Turner, who I'll probably be flip-flopping between Miss Turner and Katie Turner because I have known her since high school. So I'm very much used to calling her Miss Turner. But she was also my club coordinator for the Children's Literature Project, which is a club where we wrote children's books for homeless San Diego youth and families. Most of her work today and before meeting her in high school, however, is working with incarcerated women and improving the visitation process through literature and creative writing. And she also co-founded a bookshop inside the museum. So that's how I was able to reconnect with her, which is really cool. It was truly a pleasure to catch up with Miss Turner and also get to know this side of her that I didn't really get to know in school. And in so doing, I believe our conversation needs to be shared within the St. Andrews community, but also honestly beyond it. She ignited my love of children's literature, creative writing. She sparked my drive to use this passion for good. So I'm very confident after listening, she'll ignite a similar drive in social justice in you. So I thank Miss Turner for her time and energy, not only speaking with us at Roosevelt Group, but for actively changing the lives of so many women, families, children, and the whole San Diego community. Anyways, I'll let the recording play. So without further ado, enjoy. I'm speaking today with my OLP high school teacher, Katie Turner, who now I have the pleasure working with outside of school, which is so interesting because like I still call you Miss Turner. Like, it just feels the most
Not allowed.
natural. I know I like texted you being like, "Hi, Katie." It just sounded so weird. But truly one of my greatest inspirations. Truly, we
Oh,
talked about
thank
it
you.
at work, like who's the teachers that have like inspired you and our work together with children's literature and has literally just pivoted my inspiration. So this summer I've been working at the New Children's Museum, where my teacher Katie Turner works at Joyride, a children's literature bookshop. But yeah, I'll give it to you just as like introduction. Talk about your work, what you're focusing on now. Yeah, take it away.
So after years of teaching creative writing and AP literature, the opportunity to run the Children's Literature Project was kind of always a dream of mine. I've always been fascinated by the art of picture books.
Yes.
And I don't even necessarily call them children's books because I think as a genre, a lot of people could benefit from illustrated books.
Yes.
And I mean, some of them are coffee table level, mm-hmm. you know, quality.
Yeah.
Others are there for the hardest times in our lives. And yeah. there is something incredibly profound about the sort of visual art and poetry that mm-hmm. comes together mm-hmm. in a simple, perfect story about what it means to be human and yeah. all of the different variants in mm-hmm. humanity. So that was always something really important to me. And I think it's interesting that it's my life kind of came full circle in a way mm-hmm. with children's literature.
Yeah.
So after leaving, I left OLP because I was asked to run a state chapter of a national nonprofit mm-hmm. that works with incarcerated women. And my vice principal, when I told her, said she wasn't surprised at all.
Oh my
gosh, they knew that I was kind of headed in that direction, because at NYU, my degree was actually specifically in working with English teachers with youth who had mm-hmm. been in the carceral system.
Oh, wow.
And helping English teachers get them to reading levels when, unfortunately, because of their incarceration uh-huh. or time in, you know, CPS-based systems, they mm-hmm. Their reading level wasn't at their content level.
Yeah.
So when you have a 17-year-old who's reading at a fourth grade level, it's not okay to give them a fourth grade level book. Again, this is where picture books actually have really helped throughout my career.
Mm-hmm.
I was working in Austin, Texas, in a juvenile prison with an English teacher. Same scenario. It was young men, and there was a lot of shame around not being able to hit their 10th and 11th grade reading levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did is we chose a picture book
yeah.
That they then worked on in order to develop into a puppet show.
Yeah.
And that became a program, actually. And mm-hmm. the local elementary schools, God love them, trusted us to put on these puppet shows
yeah.
for kindergarten through second graders.
Uh-huh.
So we would actually bring these boys. They didn't have to wear their jumpsuits. They got yeah. to wear a different outfit. And on the prison bus, we would bring them to these local elementary schools mm-hmm. where they would have that sort of pride uh-huh. in reading a children's story while mm-hmm. also acting it out through puppetry and becoming heroes to
yeah.
these little kids.
Aww.
And these little kids had no idea that they yeah. had just gotten off a bus that had bars on the windows. And, you know, that directly, mm-hmm. it's those kinds of pathways that directly influence whether or not someone could or will recidivate.
Yeah.
So what occurred to me a long, long time ago is that rehabilitation through the arts mm-hmm. is incredibly important.
Oh,
and then moving to California, I frankly just needed, I needed quickly to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to get a job in an all-girls school, which was wonderful. And I really sort of honed a lot of my skills around the craft of writing
mm-hmm.
and the importance of telling stories mm-hmm. in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
And I think that that kind of all made me capable then to really go back into the world that I
yeah.
feel like is best for me.
Yeah. That's really interesting, because looking at your career in full picture, like, you've been like flowing within this like spectrum of working with underrepresented and who like need their experiences to be heard. And then you've also worked in like private. OLP was quite it was a privilege to be able to study there. So I wonder your perspective of like teaching like the spectrum of students. I think everybody is at the same level in terms of learning. And I think too, with like visual learning and the importance of pictures, like that's something that never goes away. And I think is inherent in just humans in general and how we learn, like no matter what age you are.
Well, and power and privilege and allyship are yeah. a really important thing. So, I mean, I had to take out all my like facial piercings in order mm-hmm. to get that job. I did not like give a lot of truths around, like, you know, my life, my, my, who I was living with, like any of that in order to get that job. Cause I needed a job. But in being in that environment, what occurred to me was I've seen the opposite of this private school environment. I've been in the opposite and lived in within that world. And I can actually work with young people who kind of do have the leverages of power to make sure that they are behaving in ways that are uplifting as opposed to harmful.
Oh, absolutely. No harm.
And I think if you're, if I wasn't kind of in that mind frame, I could have just, I could have just graduated year after year after year, kids who are going to go off and, you know, sort of continue to be as privileged as they were when they came in. And to kind of have the experience of the Children's Literature Project, where you're specifically working with elementary school or preschool teachers in a shelter for women and children and building a library and having the experience of providing stories that take children who are unsheltered out of that space for a little while and provide to them a different scenario about what their lives could be. I mean, I think there's nothing more important than that when you have that level of power and privilege. Use it, use it appropriately. If it goes unused, that would have been like the great heartbreak of my life. However, I did ultimately feel that me leaving that school, there's going to be a lot of other teachers who are going to come in and be awesome, but I needed to leave to go back to the environment where I felt more comfortable.
And I think that's amazing. When we all heard, it was like, oh my gosh, like she's doing it. She's like, because you instilled in us inspiration, but also like you can go out and do these things and like build from the ground up and, you know, do on the ground work to unravel the, to break down the barriers that we were seeing in our world. And I think OLP did help me like get this perspective of, and like fire and drive to truly tackle injustices in our world. And for me, it was through the appreciation of literature and it was through Children's Literature Project where I was like, you know what, my skills in writing can be put for good. And like, I figured out like, because a lot of the time I just didn't have the confidence in my creativity or in what I had to offer because it wasn't, I guess, traditional in a way of like, oh, I'm going to go pursue like science and break the glass barrier in that way. But then I realized I was like, you know what? I love kids. There's like, they're our future. They're like, who are going to make a difference in the world. Like I want to inspire them through my writing. And so you like instilled that in all of us at Children's Lit and just the OLP community in general. So when, you went off and were like, I'm going to go back and do restorative poetry and like restorative justice with women's prisons, we were all like, she's doing it. Like it was actually like seeing our passions like come to life, like through you, like you were the role model, which was really cool. And I want to tell you on behalf of the OLP community, like how much you inspired us. And I guess we can get into like your inspirations of your life. For me, like my friendships at OLP were a big inspiration as well.
Well, a lot of poets and writers and a lot of children's book authors, namely, I would say Toni Morrison has had the most influence on my the way that I think about the world. Not that... Not that Toni Morrison would care that she has had such an influence on my life.
I absolutely think she would.
I've like rarely looked up to someone in the way that I look up to her because of the way she taught me to see or to try to see. But I would say that primarily I've always been inspired. I've always been guided by my students or now my participants. Because that is where like actual meaning making takes place is by that listening process. So the Children's Literature Project that I'm working on right now inside a maximum security women's prison is completely from them. What happened is one of our participants, her son, or I'm sorry, one of our facilitators, her son was arrested last year. And he's 19 and he's facing 6 years because he was in the car during something happening. And he, she brought that up in class, just in terms of the shame that she felt about being a mother and having this experience. And what ended up happening is that everyone else in the class started talking about their own experiences of motherhood or parenting. And it, all of a sudden, we kind of all admitted what had not come into the room, but that was kind of this, was haunting the room, was children. And how many children are impacted by this experience of putting a mom away. And so it was actually my friend who's a mother herself and feeling the shame of what happened. She said it's the community that she comes from. She herself had been incarcerated. Now her son is. Her father had been. And it kind of, it generated this conversation where I'm just sitting there going, well, what are we going to do about it? And so that's now the Children's Literature Project all over again. But being run by, completely run by the women in that facility. There are no children's books in the visiting rooms. There are certainly no children's books in visitation rooms that are about having a parent who is. So the whole inspiration is how can we literally transform the system to support the children and the parents who are going through this experience? So we hired her about 9 months ago, and it's actually like it's through this kind of community of people who have been formerly incarcerated who come out and are looking for jobs and and have this wonderful opportunity to actually teach with us. They get a stipend, so it's a really great way of closing the wealth gap for formerly incarcerated women, many of whom are single moms, and then come out, and not only does the parole world like not help them at all, but they also are struggling with, you know, raising children, having been incarcerated. Anyway, so she got a job with us, and it's been instrumental because as a mother, as someone who was formerly incarcerated, that's incredibly, people who are incarcerated, seeing someone else in that room who got out of it and now is giving back and coming back and doing this trauma work. It's, you know, she's going to have more of an impact than I am, even though I am also justice involved. I am not someone who personally was incarcerated. I had family member. So that's kind of one thing. But then when she started talking about how her own son got arrested and that changed her life, she said she never really thought about it when her dad, her uncle, and herself throughout the years were in and out of prison, because it was this kind of, the neighborhood she came from is what she always says. But when her son went in at the age of 19, she thought, there's something wrong in America. There's something wrong here. They're putting, like, and this is like, this is such a complicated big thing, but prisons in the United States are storing houses for mental illness, poverty, generational cycles of racism, and drug addiction, right? It's like, it's just a catch-all for all of these social ills that no one, so no taxpayer wants to pay for equal access to education, equal access to mental health care or physical health care. But you know what California taxpayers do? Every year, their taxes pay $132,000 per person to be in prison. So like, it's, do some math on that one and let me know how many millions and millions of dollars taxpayers spend in putting someone in a place that makes them less okay when they come back out.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is like, what opened my eyes is that, and this was something in social justice with Mr. Kirschbaum brought up, was that we view prisons as just kind of like, let's store these people that are bad for society and just like store them away, like far away from society, instead of seeing it as like, let's help better our society and give them the opportunities they need to actually succeed. Yeah. Because then they come back into society and are left with like...
Well, the more insidious thing going on is mm-hmm. that, so Forever 21, mm-hmm. Purell hand sanitizer, Walmart, like yeah. all of the products that we buy mm-hmm. in this country are made inside prisons for 5 to 10 cents an hour. So, crazy. And that labor is still forced. Yeah. So you're forced to work in California 4 hours a day. So forced labor for 5 cents an hour is pretty darn close to slavery.
Yeah. Close.
And then when you get out, in California, you get $200. In New York, you get $50 when you get out. And good luck to you. And yeah. by the way, your punishment isn't over because you're still on parole. Mm. And with a felony, there's all sorts of doors that never open again for you. Like yeah. in Florida, you can't vote.
Yeah.
Right. Ever again. So you the punishment never ends.
Uh-huh.
And so what are your options? Mm-hmm. And that's why you have high recidivism rates,
mm-hmm.
because the option is to go back to whatever it was that you were doing to get by, whether yeah. that's masking your feelings with drugs, or whether that's, you know, petty robberies and things like mm-hmm. that, hustling, mm-hmm. you know, check fraud. Things like that that end you up in this cycle.
Yes.
And so rehabilitation is in the name of a lot of prisons. Like the CDCR stands for the California Department of Rehabilitation, yeah. And of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And yet less than yes. 1% of that number I gave you, $132,000 mm-hmm. a person.
Yeah.
Less than 1% of that goes to rehabilitation.
That's crazy.
So the thing that we know that works.
Uh-huh.
Less than 1% of taxpayer money goes to any rehabilitation program.
Wow.
I have to completely finance uh-huh. my entire program because I was an yeah. AP literature teacher on writing grants uh-huh. all day long every day.
Yeah.
Because no one is going to help me do rehabilitation, which actually works.
Which actually matters, yeah.
Right, and the one thing that yeah. we have now, like, really dug into is this, what has been revealed to us after years of mm-hmm. gaining trust among women,
yeah,
is the child separation.
Mm-hmm.
And the, like, what has happened because of child separation to their own
yeah.
recovery process. They are grieving their children every day,
mm-hmm.
but also what's happening to their children.
Yeah.
They're being bullied. They are feeling very othered. They feel uh-huh. like, they also feel like maybe mom chose
uh-huh.
whatever happened over them. So there are
it's
psychological
so
problems
yeah.
that are like extensive.
Uh-huh.
And what can we do? Well, we're a creative writing rehabilitative program
yeah.
that our incarcerated advisory board has now decided we are going to become
mm-hmm.
like really focused on this, because mm-hmm. 70% of our participants are parents.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of people without their moms or caregiver,
mm-hmm.
You know, in the, mm-hmm. At home, and they're trying to grow
yeah.
up parenting from inside.
Yeah.
So when you do when you get a phone call from prison,
uh-huh.
it's only 15 minutes and then they shut it down.
Yeah.
And then every 5 minutes, mm-hmm. a recording comes on to let you know that you're being listened to.
Uh-huh.
And that this yeah. is being recorded. And that
yeah.
there are ramifications
yeah.
for things that you might be talking about.
And I guess you don't even think about how intimidating and like even dehumanizing just that simple sentence is of... you're talking or you are on the phone with San Diego County Jail and what you are saying is being recorded. What if you're a kid just trying to like say, hi mom, like I had a rough day at school today. They're not going to talk about that rough day at school when they know that like some outside third party, like big brother type person
that's
could
it.
Be listening.
That's right.
You know?
That's number one. Number two, can you imagine your mother walking into a visitation room in shackles?
Uh-huh. Oh my God. No.
The other thing is over 90% of our participants are survivors of sexual trauma.
Yeah.
And in order to get into the visitation room,
mm-hmm.
so the United States is the last and only developed country in the world that still cavity searches women.
Wow.
And so if you are a survivor of trauma,
yeah.
in order to see your child, you have to be cavity searched on the way in and on the way out.
Mm-mm.
There are a lot of people who choose, rather than seeing their own child, they choose not to so that they don't have to be re-traumatized. Yeah. And then the right after that happens, the doors open and there's your six-year-old.
Yeah.
And you're crying and you're freaking out and your anxiety levels are really high.
Yeah.
You're angry, confused, mm-hmm. frustrated, right? So like it is, there are so many like problems and like how and in what ways can we like take steps toward actually reimagining the visitation space, but then also creating picture books that allow children and parents to reimagine the experience of having an incarcerated parent.
Yes.
Because right now there are less than 5 books mm-hmm. that are about an incarcerated mother. There are very few children's books about an incarcerated parent at all. But less than 5 are about a mother because it's the double shame. Uh-huh. Not only, no one expected you to get incarcerated, you're a woman, right? Uh-huh. Number one. But number two, a mother? How could you have done that? How could you have done that to your kids, right? So that double harm, that double shame makes it so that it's almost like we've erased the problem. And so you have 190,000 women currently incarcerated on any given day in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Close to 200,000 women at any given time in the United States.
Yeah.
200,000 women, 70% of them at least have one kid.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of kids with no access to tools and to help them work through what's happening and develop healthy relationships with their mom.
Yeah. And that's truly breaking the system, because when you look at the numbers, it's a number. Like I read, you know, right now we have about 2 million Americans that are in prison. That's about 1% of our adult population. But those are the people that are just like in the prison. And if they're adults, like what about their mothers, their fathers? What about their kids? What about those kids' kids? Because it just keeps going.
Right.
It's crazy to think about.
Mass incarceration has wrecked so many communities, and it's not normal.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen in other countries.
Yeah.
We have 3 times the amount of incarcerated people than China. And if you look at the population of China and the United States, what we have done is an egregious form of maintaining slavery and maintaining oppression and capitalist oppression because you're forcing people to make cheap products.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, it's egregious on a level that once you know about it, you can't believe that people allow it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then the narrative, which I know you saw, like, we are rewriting narratives because the narrative is on local news that it's bad guys who go to jail, right?
And it goes to show how like powerful knowledge production is, and just like because of the media, but also how like subconscious the problem of like mass incarceration is in the U.S.
Right.
On just a social level.
And like less than 5% of women are like actually violent in California prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And that actual violence, that is mental illness.
Yeah.
So even that is a mental illness that was never captured as in childhood and dealt with because you have these confluences, right, of poverty and mental illness, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then what ends up happening is there's no safety net.
Yes.
There's no community net for noticing that there might be psychopathy in less than 5% of the community, right?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe there is somebody who experiences psychopathy, which, by the way, the highest percentage of psychopathy in the United States is on Wall Street.
Oh, wow.
But literally, there are more people with sociopathic tendencies, right? Like an inability to feel compassion.
Yeah. On Wall Street.
Yes. Than there are in our prisons.
Yeah.
Because prisons are where people are put for, especially, I can speak only for the population of people identified as women and gender diverse who are in women's prisons.
Yeah.
That what they're going to jail and prison for are acts of desperation. Right? Or acts of mental illness and drug addiction, like kind of as recourse for those issues.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about that, and then you think, yeah, put them in there, in this place that'll make it worse.
Worse.
And then when they come out, yeah, we won't give them any help. What are you doing?
Yeah.
And why?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there are and can be alternatives.
Exactly.
To incarceration that allow parents to stay with their children, mm-hmm. that allow people who have made mistakes mm-hmm. to get help with mental illness and drug addiction,
yeah.
right? That allow people to actually be able to afford to live in an apartment rather mm-hmm. than have to live in their car.
Yeah.
You know, if you're homeless in California with mm-hmm. children, they will take your children and put them in CPS.
Yeah.
So if you're a single mom living in a car,
yeah.
you could have your kids taken away from you rather than get an apartment
yeah.
and be helped.
Yeah.
Right? It's mm-hmm. just as common that the kids go because they're in an unsafe environment, mm. right? Yeah. So the problems seem to kind of splinter and fracture out for days, right?
Oh,
you could do
yeah.
like 16 different PhDs mm-hmm. on this issue.
Yeah.
But where I really focus is in the triage of human beings who are currently incarcerated in uh-huh. women's prisons.
Yeah.
And what can I do to support them right now? And right now, you know, last spring when all of this kind of came out, you know, they missed their kid's
yeah.
prom. Like they didn't get to, right? Yeah. Like they didn't get to be there for that, mm-hmm. right? They didn't get to like go look for a dress with their daughter, mm-hmm. whatever. Like all of these little things that you don't really think about that are mm-hmm. the things that you get to do with your parents.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's gone. It's not an option.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
and I think,
yeah.
Anyway. Like, I think that's such a beautiful way to start is like through children's literature and also the mother's perspective.
Yeah.
Because it really breaks it down to its like core humanity of like an issue. Because we can look at the big picture and like look at it, and it gets overwhelming sometimes. It's important to break it down into all these different branches of, okay, this, we have this huge systemic issue. We can take a look at it through like a woman's perspective, a man's perspective. How is the media talking about it now? How can we break that down and like reimagine a totally new system that starts at the root of the problem? But I think like children's literature is a good way to just start on a moral equal playing field, I feel like. I don't know if that's
I mean,
how you feel too.
So one of our participants mm-hmm. Was being abused by her partner for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
She eventually, which is, I mean, this is the case for a lot of them. I would say a majority of them actually,
mm-hmm.
her crime was in self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
And she is now in prison.
That's crazy.
And she has no idea when she's ever going to get out. Mm-hmm. And her daughter is now being raised. So mm-hmm. she was arrested when her daughter was 5. She's now being raised by another family member who has decided to lie to uh-huh. her daughter. And my participant has also been told, you have to lie about where you are. So the little girl uh-huh. thinks that her mom is in college. And when
wow.
she was 5,
yeah.
that was okay. But now she's 9.
Uh-huh.
And the last time she came for a visit, she asked, mm-hmm. I don't understand why this college has barbed wire. And I don't understand why you all have to wear the same clothes.
Oh my gosh.
And the participant is extremely distraught about that. So what's going to happen when her daughter actually grows up and finds out where her mom is? And then feels like, well, not only did you go away and you weren't there mm-hmm. when I needed you, but you lied to me about mm-hmm. where you were, right?
Yeah.
That's what this woman is facing. She made a decision mm-hmm. to end someone's life because of what he was doing to her and her daughter.
Yeah.
But she made that decision mm-hmm. and she's having to live with that decision to take someone's life.
Mm-hmm.
And now her daughter's life and her life have also been taken.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And so where is the children's book for that child
mm-hmm.
and for other children like her?
Yeah.
Where's the book that will help her?
Mm-hmm.
And the trauma that she has experienced and will continue to experience as mm-hmm. this whole thing unfolds in this little girl's life.
Yeah.
And how do we as a society take responsibility for that little girl? Because she certainly had no part in what happened.
No part.
But her mom does deserve, as far as I understand, she deserves to tell her daughter that story in a safe way. And I
Absolutely.
Think children's literature is the place to do that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think there is there's this tension between how much do we tell them and like prepare them for the world and how much do we like shelter them away? And I think like,
well, that is a privilege to be able to shelter a child.
That's true.
I mean, because if you've never had a SWAT team come into your house and take your parent, then
there's a lot of power at play there.
Then you get to be like, oh, I don't want to show my kids this thing that might upset them. But when you come from a heavily policed community, you don't have that privilege.
Yeah, that's like, it's interesting to point out that like the power of choosing, what do we teach children, what do we don't? And I remember that also came into play. This is just reminding me of, I was supposed to work at Drag Queen Story Hour. And that was a huge, that exploded. And I was like, simply just somebody, an entertainer coming to read a children's book to a child.
Joy.
To bring joy.
Joy.
Just for a day. Yeah. And I was excited. We had to sign like a thing, a waiver being like, I'm fine with literally being hate crimed as an employee if like protesters came at me.
Yeah.
And that is crazy.
Yeah.
But it's important to look at those power dynamics. And
what about the children who need those books?
And the children who need those
books. And frankly,
books.
All children need those books.
Exactly.
And that's that's why we've been accepted at South by Southwest to do some like and the National Council on Teachers of English. We're going to these major national conferences next year with this program because teachers need to stock their classrooms with books that meet the needs of all children.
Yes.
And even if there's a child in your classroom who doesn't happen to be justice involved, which good luck finding one in the United States, but even if, you know, you have some situation where no one in your class has ever had a family member who's in prison, you still need to read those books.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you continue to erase human beings who are sitting behind these walls.
Exactly.
Literally, like intentionally being erased from society.
Yeah.
Their names are taken away. They are known by their DOC numbers.
Yeah.
They are not known by their names.
Exactly.
So yeah. So erasure is something that we can combat by like working with teachers, working with librarians, and working with publishers to bring these stories outside of these walls.
Yeah. And I think this is a good way to start wrapping it up is some advice you could give to the St. Andrews community, OLP community, people here sitting at Bean Sprouts Cafe and going to your bookstore on just, I don't know, bettering our society. I know that's a big question, but I don't know.
Well, I would say, and I've always felt this way, one person at a time, like sit with one person.
Yeah.
You know, learn from one person.
Mm-hmm.
And because a person is a universe of experiences.
Exactly.
You know, and lived experiences are important to teaching you how to decenter your own and make room for others.
Yeah.
So I guess I would say that's number one. And number two would be read.
Read. Read past your bedtime.
Read past your bedtime.
No, that is true. It's opened a whole world for me. Going back and reading children's literature as an adult has opened worlds for me.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think one person at a time is really great advice. I mean, even just through this podcast, I'm realizing it's truly a village. And that's something also from my last podcast with my dad, like I realized, like, when we're talking face to face, I'm not talking to just Katie Turner.
Mm-mm.
I'm talking to Katie Turner, who's read Toni Morrison, who has met and spoken with
hundreds of friends
incarcerated
in prison.
Women,
yes.
Whose stories need to be heard more. And now it just opened up this whole world, which I'm so excited for the St. Andrews community to hear about.
Well,
and I want the whole
time.
World to hear about.
Appreciate
of course.
It.
Yeah. And then, fun last little icebreaker question. I was going to open up with, what is your favorite like children's lit story or children's story?
Oh my God, how can you ask me something like that? I own a children's bookstore.
A cool children's lit store that runs on wheels, which is so fun. And I wish we could get into more, but check it out.
I have two. One is wordless. And
Ooh.
One isn't. The wordless one is called Migrants by Issa Watanabe.
Okay.
And the way that she tells the story of migration, it's animals, but they're in kind of human form.
Oh, I love that.
And it is truly one of the most spectacular books I've ever been able to experience. And then the second one is called My Poppy is a Clown. My Daddy is a Clown. Some iteration so of father cute. Is yeah. a clown. And it's about Aww. A little boy who has a father who's a psychologist and a father who is a clown, like actually a clown.
Oh, I love it.
It's in Spanish. Oh. And it is... it's just joyful. It's just a joyful story.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's what, you know what, even as adults we need is just some joy. It's important to tackle big societal issues, but sometimes it gets overwhelming and you just need that joy.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's
so
beautiful.
Yes, I'm going to take a look at it. But yeah, thank you so much for your time. It's been so great to catch up and hear more about what you're doing, because I'm telling you, when you left, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. I want to like keep in touch with this woman. Like, she's inspiring me. So this is truly a privilege.
Thank you.
To talk to you, and an honor. So yeah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Let you go. I appreciate it even more. All right. Bye.